Got a community discussion on the rides today, talking around the labor that's gone, has gone, and is continuing to go into our important movement. It's a topic that I've sort of been grappling with for a very long time and wanted to just have some candid conversation around everyone today on what the next steps look like. As I was greatly inspired by a quote from Bibik, he says that really what we're doing, it's history in the making. And it seems like we have a real opportunity to do something that it's been attempted before. Certainly, for instance, I'd say Bitcoin was probably the first shot at something like this, where there was a decentralized group of people that didn't really know each other. It was all pseudonymous. You had maybe a picturesque name or a public key or something like that. But, you know, the actual efforts, the work, the ongoing developments weren't orchestrated by a centralized corporation of sorts. There is no one Bitcoin organization that quote unquote controls the network. It's really more about an idea that one person or group of people had that transformed into a completely new view, not just on, you know, financial systems or distributed accounting, but really on an overarching decentralized governance structure based on provable mathematics. That was sort of his, Nakamoto's, initial start. They were building something that was provably not controlled by one person. And that creates a lot of really interesting downstream resiliency effects when it comes to, in Bitcoin's case, the network and the stability. And there are definitely some nuances around it that maybe don't get the limelight they deserve. We had Bob speak up and talk about a mining company recently, and it calls into question the growing power usage of these facilities. And it's all really based off of one thing, and that's the consensus mechanism that Nakamoto pioneered as a way to translate real-world value into digital value. And I'll touch on that. The particular proof-of-work consensus is concerning to me for a number of reasons. Vitalik points out that mining is fairly inherently centralized when you need to consume so much electrical power. The government certainly can figure out who's who and doing what. And the China ban really was, I think, just straight up point for this, in that there was a little bit more central control and real world governmental abuses that could happen on the consensus front that, you know, it might not be able to happen on the actual ownership front. But if there's no network consensus, then does the ownership really matter? It's certainly something that we've seen. There are chains that have gone through 51% attacks. Ethereum Classic is still worth some marketable value, even though you can do something like this on it because there is not enough network support on the consensus side. And that's interesting. That's a nuance that is not really talked about on a wide scale. And it's something that I think is really important, because ultimately the chief resource of a society is not electricity. It's not the value of how much of an asset you've accumulated, but it's labor. There are no buildings without labor. There are no inventions without labor. And dare I say, innovation grinds to a halt without the prudent efforts of not only the organizers of efforts, but the much, much larger number of ongoing human souls needed to bring those ideas, missions, objectives, however you want to frame it, These are all fundamentally human concepts, and to take them to fruition requires a dedicated amount of ongoing efforts. Now, capitalism sort of approached this from the view of a carrot and a stick, in that you could allocate capital to the ones with ideas, and they would distribute the capital to people that needed work, right? They wanted to turn their labor into fiat, right? And interestingly, with this model, it naturally results in the centralization of capital in a few hands of a few people that have it, first of all, and then secondly, know how to efficiently allocate it, and thirdly, can do that and are willing to work and put it out there as a service to everyone around them. And so naturally, the groups of labor became inherently centralized. And this is a really big nuanced topic that I think will really serve as the foundation for what the next era of the internet, the world, and government itself looks like in the coming ages. And on this note, I want to bring it back to the ongoing discussion we have about all the work that's been happening in the community for years now without explicit profit motive. There are an unbelievable amount of community members, the vast majority of them, I'd purport, that really just do this for their own, just because it's the right thing to do, because we're putting together a system that benefits everyone, that is more efficient, more empowering, more accessible. And whether that's through transparency, whether it's through ease of use, whether it's through just having your vote counted in the first place, these are all fundamental challenges that shouldn't, they just should work for a system of capitalism. And unfortunately, we've seen that that might not be the case vis-a-vis the sneeze. And so that's why I think we have a really interesting opportunity to take our movement and, instead of relying on a central foundation that is always out seeking money, trying to get grants, that's a lot of work, and it's a material expense for traditional foundations, especially if it's not a very clear humanitarian. If you look at the top charities by how efficient they are at fundraising, it's very clear humanitarian things like curing cancer, solving world hunger, you know, giving people clean drinking water. These are things that anyone could really get behind. It's pretty easy to make a donation to that over and over. But there are a lot of very nuanced technical implementations that could be brought to the internet, that could be brought to society, and that could be distributed across the globe that will have a massive empowering effect on every single person that uses the platforms, the nuanced developments, and the ongoing efforts of, in a large part, open source developers, but not just developers, it's open source anything, it's decentralized anything, it's the education, it's the reform. If you look at the large group, very large group on across all the social platforms that are working to reform our markets today, that is very nuanced, very important, and unfortunately very overlooked work that has a real effect. If you can increase everyone's retirement portfolios by a couple of percentage points a year by making the system more efficient, that has a real impact. And the challenge is, and I saw this firsthand trying to get grants while I was in college for Black Transfer, it's a lot of work to apply for these kinds of grants. We applied to a ton of them, and it takes a lot of concerted effort. We got a few of them, luckily, but a vast majority of them was nothing. And if you want to build something that's designed principally to benefit the users, then very quickly, in my view, and this is sort of, I think, what the community has come to, the question is, should there be any really rent-extracting profit motive in what you're developing? And for us, clearly, it's just education, it's advocacy, it's bringing forth this better system. And if we agree that that's the case, then quickly the question becomes, well, how do you allocate the capital? Because traditionally, if you want to put the capital into an idea, into an organization, into an effort, that either requires extensive nonprofit fundraising activity, or you're rich. I mean, that's another option. But the third option is that you sort of take on capital from investors and try to, you know, create returns. And for a lot of cases, that makes sense. But the challenge comes in the later stages when you're really thinking longer term about what you're building. If you're trying to put a system together, an education group together, or an organization that really isn't out to seek profits and sell things or make a ton of money, but instead to just have an impact, have an effect, and achieve a cause. And maybe that cause takes a few years to achieve. Maybe it takes organizing a whole lot of other organizations around it. And maybe ultimately takes a few decades to achieve. But once it's achieved, sort of you have that agreement, it's and everyone's succeeded, it's definitely not the same as the traditional charitable work where, you know, there's to fix drinking water, you sort of have to put a well on every town step, and that's a mammoth task. But the cool thing about the internet is that we have this opportunity now in Web3 where we can build things, and then they just work, and they're self-fulfilling, and they have their own incentives that the users are already sort of tied into. And that's where I think we have a really interesting opportunity. Now, normally when you're sort of building, let's use maybe a GNU Linux as an example, something that is not designed for profits, but just a piece of software that the world can use and does use today. Basically, everything functions on it. All the servers, everything at scale. It's a critical piece of our planet. And its development and ongoing support, as we heard from Anuhia, is chiefly done through corporate sponsors, where they have sort of the centralized pool capital and they decide it's in their best interest to hire these individuals to go work on it. And that's tremendous for established and big projects. It took decades for that to happen. But what about those upstarts? What about the new projects? And most importantly, what about the protocols that aren't like a cryptocurrency where you're just issuing something, it's it mass and selling it to the public? And they're also not a traditional company where it's structured around the idea of returning money to the shareholders and having sort of a long-term ongoing improvement. But what about just that basic infrastructure, that sort of the protocol level developments, TCP/IP, RSS, SSL, these very, very foundational tools of the web that come from grassroots ongoing research efforts? And with just those three, for example, you're looking at decades between each of them actually being invented, then coming to fruition. And it's just not very fast. The innovation is entirely in the hands of a couple of people's spare time, because there's really no incentive and almost no reward mechanism for them. Case in point, the Heartbleed hack, where there was a vulnerability in SSL for months, because there was like two people doing it part time, and it was nothing, right? This is what happens when we fail as a society to allocate funds towards public goods, and while physical public goods, excludable public goods like the public water and the local parks and feeding the homeless, those are certainly, I would say, excludable goods, meaning that there's only so much here, so much there. It's a very scarce resource, at least scarce to the extent that there's only so much of it in the physical real world. And the incredible thing about the internet is that now we have the opportunity to build non-scarce, abundant public goods that just work for everybody on an ongoing basis, they're designed not to keep a corporation rich and, you know, give its shareholders returns for the next 200 years and extract as much and much as they can, but more so built to serve a community. And right now this is done through, in one way, sponsorships, and in another way, blockchain grants. I'm going to start on blockchain grants because it seems the most relevant and I have a few insights into it. So, you know, I've been working for years in the space and try it on a large number of occasions to get grants from these traditional sources where they have their crypto and it's sort of the foundation or something related to the foundation of the launch of the token and the sort of launch of the coin, and they're working to foster, you know, more development in the community. And what I've seen time and time again is that the focus quite often is not on the large scale impact or net societal benefit that a project brings. It's not about really adding value to the world at large, but instead it's revolved almost exclusively around adding value to the particular token or coin or blockchain network that the grant is associated with. And, you know, this is, it makes sense. It's almost self-interested. And the majority of foundations in the real world have a stark difference to this, where they're just trying to do things to help people. They're just, I mean, there are foundations that do nothing but give away money to random people in developing nations. It's a purely humanitarian gifted effort. And unfortunately, something like that, it doesn't exist for public goods. That, in my view, they're all tied around developing network incentives, even to the point where there was one development where it was just a class. It was a community sponsored, you get a coach and they'd come in and teach a course for you on the internet. And even to apply to that, you had to pass certain expectations and rules that were put in place for projects that would ultimately build on the network and deploy to add value to that coin and to further their blockchain. And while that's fine and dandy, it doesn't solve, in my view, the pressing problem of decentralizing labor and incentivizing people to work on something that they think is a good idea. And what I mean by this is that in the traditional corporate structure and the existing centralized view of capitalism, there's sort of an ongoing process where somebody that's sort of quote-unquote above you in the hierarchy has an idea. Maybe the board of directors comes up with a strategic vision, and maybe an investor proposes something. And these ideas sort of funnel their way down in the organization to the point where the everyday people like you and me who are actually working on it really don't have a connection with the inspiration in a vast majority of organizations. We don't have a connection with the reasoning behind the development. And very often it looks like you're following barking orders instead of, you know, innovating or building what you think would be best. Something that comes to mind when I talk about this concept is the Hudsucker proxy, where the CEO jumps out of a 44th floor window at the start of the film, and the board decides they want to tank the stock price so they can buy up a bunch of cheap shares. So they find some smug off the street who has no job, no work experience whatsoever, and just decide he'll be the CEO of the company for the next few months, so it'll tank the stock price. And then this random guy invents the hula hoop and gets the company to mass produce the hula hoop, and, you know, because it's a huge success, they make an unbelievable amount of money. The stock goes crazy and everyone gets super mad. And there's a scene in the movie where an elevator operator who had originally connected with the protagonist now is bringing, you know, now he's CEO. And this was before the board appointed him, they sort of built this rapport. So he comes into his office as a CEO and suggests this idea of a Frisbee. And he gets the protagonist shuts him down, laughs him out, says, how could you ever think of something? You're just this elevator operator. You could never do anything smart. Even though not 2 weeks ago or, you know, just 20 minutes in the movie ago, he was at the exact same stature. And for me, that really made me realize that the best ideas are not the ones that have the most polish or the most thought and contemplation put into them at the start. They're not the ones that are sort of directed top down into a mandate, but rather there are ideas that come from the users, the engineers, the builders themselves, that really have a vision of what could be in the world. And unfortunately, unless you are extremely lucky to get randomly put in place as a CEO as part of some scheme, that elevator operator, for instance, will never get a chance to make his Frisbee. He'll never get the opportunity to bring that vision to a reality without the right connections, and particularly without access to capital. And for traditional physical saleable goods like that that are built around the tradition, you know, the normal corporate structure of making, selling, and profiting off of things, that's who needs access to the capital markets. Unfortunately, small businesses have the hardest time raising capital, and it's just not right. I think that can be made so much more efficient using blockchain, but that's sort of a separate discussion on how capital is distributed and accessing it. I want to take that example and segue it into the public goods space. Now, let's imagine that it's a similar story, but instead of trying to make some, consumer good, it's an idea for a new method of extracting carbon from the atmosphere. That is something that is highly speculative, and maybe you want to make a company around it. Maybe you want to make it a public good. That's where it starts to blur the lines. And then on the far end of that spectrum is where I think there are things that are very clearly designated to be public goods. And that's things like protocol layer money infrastructure for the web, protocol layer securities infrastructure for the network, and anything that's putting something in code that's a standard that can be used for the rest of time. I don't see a universe where TCP/IP isn't sort of used or is part of a basis for something. And there are plenty of very interesting projects like Braid that are trying to take these protocol level concepts and innovate them into the next level of a decentralized Web3. And a lot of these challenges, like who's going to fund IPFS development, there are a lot of nuanced technical projects that don't get the funding they deserve because they're not built on a token or chain or coin. They're not designed to bring value to any particular ecosystem. But that is the unfortunate part. And ideally, we'll see more and more things getting built on blockchains that actually can add value to the ecosystems. And in some sense of the growth of that network, they can capture some of those gains themselves. But there's always going to be, I think, certain things that, and even for those projects, the problem becomes how to bootstrap it, how to fund the startup costs. When you're thinking about how to build block transfer, sort of had two options to choose from in our original thesis. The first was what we went with on Stellar, and the second was OX. OX at the time was a decentralized protocol that was built around creating order books for traditional and existing Web3 assets. And it was very promising technology, used a lot of really cool, it was really the way that you would want to implement order books if you're doing it through a federated system and not on an L1 chain. Somewhere along the line, OX took some big investments from Silicon Valley names, and now it's sort of more like a software as a service operation. It's no longer this promising protocol to decentralize order books and really facilitate global capital liquidity. And rather, it's now more around taking in money for a centralized entity. On the flip side of this argument is Eric Verhoes' Shapeshift, which started out as a centralized exchange of sorts, profiting off of trades between wallets with crypto. And they faced a very heavy onslaught of regulatory scrutiny as they scaled, as you might expect for someone trying to be a centralized exchange. This is why we have securities laws. It's why Citadel can't just go and open some trading venue without a lot of scrutiny, because there are very inherent conflicts of interest in any kind of trading infrastructure. Charging fees to the users means that they get less of what they want to trade for. That's how every stock trading exchange system works. If it's not built on a protocol level that has its own nonprofit incentives and structure in code, you can provably say that this will never charge the fee for the protocol. And that is a very unique and special thing that is only possible when you have a lot of initial nonprofit source funding. And when I say a lot, I mean a lot. OpenAI tried to go down this path with their entire company, found doing it all off of donations. And this is the problem they ran into. They got a couple of really smart Silicon Valley guys to put in very large amounts of money. But it doesn't matter how many people you can get to donate $50 million if you need billions and billions of dollars to make your vision a reality. And unfortunately, there's nothing at that scale yet to provide that funding for what would otherwise be an open public good. That's where I think the governance here is really powerful. It's a tool that lets us incentivize the creation of standards for an entire network. I saw OpenAI has this Whisper protocol or program, or it's all proprietary, right? So you don't even really know what it is. They have this Whisper product where it's speech to text, right? And that's something that I see people creating open source replica versions of today. If OpenAI could have just made theirs open source, then all of that human labor, all of that effort, and surely it's more than one person trying to do this, because it's not unified, it's not organized, and it's not specialized to one standardized interface. It's just a waste of it's just a waste of labor. And if we consider and agree that labor is the most valuable resource, our time, our efforts, our energies are the most valuable resource we'll ever have, more than capital. So much more. Then, very clearly, these centralizing public projects that build something anyone could use but then kind of keep it to themselves and sell it and extract rent from it, unfortunately, it leads to just a tremendous waste of human labor because of the duplicative effect. You can't build an oil pipeline right next to an oil pipeline. It makes no economic sense. And that seems to be what's happening with a lot of this web development, where we could all just use a unifying standard. If only there was some way to give these projects, these founders and these engineers, enough money, incentive, and long-term view to build it for the public from day one and stick with that vision and have the resources to turn it into a community-driven reality. And that's why I think the magic of what we're doing through Discord, although it is proprietary, closed source, and it's not this open platform, it really is this pathway where we can connect and sort of, in my view, becoming the new Slack, right? I mean, it's where you could go to do work on the community's projects. And the question is, well, if we all agree that we're going to come together and work on these important fundamental public utilities and want that to have funding. Where does the funding come from? This is really the bigger challenge that I've been trying and etching with in the long term for a long time, because ultimately it comes down to either facilitating a lot of donations, which in itself I think is a costly and socially wasteful thing, where you're just spending a lot of money on media advertisements, and it's one way to go, but to think that you would be just profiting these centralized and extractive social platforms, for me that is not a, it's just, it's not a path that is efficient, that makes sense. I mean, in a perfect world, right, there wouldn't even be sort of these legacy costs to transfer the money. And those are the kinds of challenges that we could really solve using decentralized technology. And the problem is that the only way today that this is all really incentivized without central coordination is through the charity of sponsorships. For instance, the only way that I've been paid anything in the last, because most of my assets I've just kind of stashed away in cash so I can keep funding the business, the only way I've really been paid anything is through GitHub sponsors, because Chives decided he would pledge $20 a month for me to be able to work on what I'm working on. And then this last week, this last month is where things started to change. I started working on open source grants in the Stellar ecosystem, building out their own technology. And with that, I did get, I'm finishing it up now, it'll be about $1,000 in the token, in the coin. And for me, we've got certainly some contracts down the road, but these are big projects that are collaborations and take a long time and a lot of resources and ongoing capital to really deal with. So the question is, how do you bootstrap it? How do you strap it up? Because sponsorships themselves, they are fickle. Donations are, you know, it's a nuanced and challenged topic, because on one hand, we want to decentralize capitalism in the sense that it really is spread out to the people. And on the other hand, we want to put these funds towards an ongoing goal. And that ongoing goal needs to have some kind of central treasury, so to speak, just so that there's a resource for creators, for the, you know, the people that actually work on it and labor through the nuance, the developments of the protocol, for instance, know that there is a guarantee that they'll get paid by sort of the pool of assets. And traditionally, this gets done through sort of a job boards or one kind of company owning and managing the grants. And as I've said, this has been a really big point of tension for me in the past, because a lot of times these sorts of individuals and the organizations built up around them, they have a set of people at the top that dictate what gets funded. And so you can work and work and work on applications and grants and the nuanced trying to explain it to them, but that's a whole job in itself. And a lot of times what I found is it just doesn't get rewarded, as I said. And this is where I think DAOs, and especially for what we're talking about here, nonprofit DAOs, have a very big potential that is unrealized and laundered, just waiting, latent, for an application and a community that can really show the world that this actually does work. You don't need to have millions in backing from one person to build something that has a real impact, that is a grassroots effort, and has not only large goals, but really focus on that mission and creates a product that the world can use as standards that affects everyone. And the biggest nuance here is that you can have a central pool of capital in the structure of the on-chain holdings of a DAO, but the decisions of who gets to get the funding, and this is the really important distinction, decisions aren't made by a select few people or even a committee of a couple dozen smart people, as is traditional in nonprofits. But instead, you can allocate the funding on the basis of what the actual members of the community think should get funded. And you can do it in an egalitarian way, where the biggest project might get 1,000 votes, and the smallest project might get 100 votes. And using the magic of quadratic funding, where there's sort of a tapering off of how much money you get, the more votes you get, the community can actually intelligently allocate capital, not just to the things that are the traditionally most popular and clear winners of the world, but they can allocate capital at scale in a meaningful way to projects like SSL that a couple of people might understand are really important, while most people ignore it, and allow those developers to sustain themselves and to really focus on the actual work that they want to do, the ideas that they do have, and the fixes they can bring, so that there aren't heartbleeds or hacks or these nuanced challenges in protocol development in the future. Because ultimately, a lot of times, I've found talking with very, very, like, PhD CS guys that I have such respect for will never be at that level. They have such an unbelievable understanding of what they're doing, and it is so complicated that you really do need that level of understanding. And for them to, they shouldn't need to waste half of a day that could be spent building something that adds literally millions of dollars in value. They shouldn't need to spend that time getting a grant application together for like $5,000 of funding just so they can pay their rent. And unfortunately, that seems to be the case today if you're not working at a centralized organization that appreciates your skill set. The only way, of course, to do that is through a job application with those organizations. And the job application itself is permissioned. That is the definition of permission, and yet it is foundational to almost all human labor. And as soon as you introduce the need for permission, even if it's like a low bar, I got my first job at Subway. I walked into a Walmart, had a 20-minute interview, and walked out. That's still a bar that is a hurdle for people to overcome, and it's only geometrically larger as you get to more complex challenges and developments. And I've seen these interviews where it's on the phone and you've got the guy on ChatGPT trying to BS his way through it. And unfortunately, that's only become more of a reality as these technologies progress. And in my view, the only way to solve this is to decentralize the labor process itself. You need to remove that one decision maker who decides if you, or the group of decision makers that decides if your labor is worth being compensated enough so that you can live in the world, to giving the power back to the individuals themselves, the laborers who put in the effort, the ones who really understand the challenges that they're working every day to solve. This is something that I introduced to the community. We were trying to develop a Stellar Lumens physical coin image, and I introduced it not just to our DRS world, but also into the Stellar developer world through a GitHub issue directly under a grant bounty. And unfortunately, there are like three people that decide if that kind of stuff gets funded. And the answer for me was no. The answer for our community was no, even though it's sort of a net benefit having this piece of media PR sort of representation of the coin, of the value and such. Like, that is exclusively for the network. And yet it receives no funding because you have to fit your ideas into a budget proposal, into a sector, into an industry that fits on the balance sheet as a category. And, I mean, all that does is make it more challenging to allocate capital. And the more friction you introduce, the less efficient the final system is. Web3 gives us this promise. It lets you, with no one's permission, deposit assets into a smart contract and get back money. To think that you could act as your own bank, comparing that to the existing world, if I wanted to do that, I'd have to walk into a bank branch, spend hours, and, you know, have to work with another person. And that might seem like, oh, I'm, you know, the social part of it definitely, I think, rings out to me as an important factor. I'm an introvert at heart. And to think that if we could just not only remove the whole process, but also like half the population's introverts, and they would be doing so much better, in my view, in building out this future for themselves, if they didn't have to struggle with the challenges of, for a lot of people, the social interaction part, that is an actual deterrent to commerce. And it's just so unfortunate. And this is even more true in the capital raising field of small business. You know, if you don't have the skills to do an eloquent pitch, then unfortunately, just because of human psyche, there's a natural tendency to say, oh, well, this is probably not a good project. And that's not efficient. I remember 5 years ago, I was working with a nonprofit doing financial education, literacy, coaching, and the sorts in my local community. And for a couple of months, I worked with their founder to build out and develop these educational resources, most of which have made their way onto my YouTube. And while I was young and naive at the time, I was really putting in a lot of effort, and we'd done a lot of work together, all through email. We had one introductory meeting in person, and then it was just asynchronous, all online. Maybe we had one other meeting. And then it got to the point where they were going to introduce me to someone who was very famous and sort of had the potential to, you know, take what I was working on and really, you know, send it at scale. And unfortunately, I was just, you know, young, starting off in college, and I missed the meeting for one reason or another. I made a mistake, and I hopped in like the last 2 minutes of the scheduled meeting time, and they were still talking just to each other, but personally really ruined the whole relationship, destroyed that opportunity, and, you know, it was very unfortunate, because it was a chance to get that book, Nine to Noon, in front of a lot of people. And so I've worked tirelessly since then to put out all this educational content, to make the book free, to make the courses free, to teach, you know, these very crucial investing principles. But it always sort of rung in the back of my mind that I was late from the dry cleaners, and I might have just missed like the greatest opportunity to get influence, to spread the message. I mean, in a certain sense, I'm sort of thankful that it happened, because I probably would have used it to just go into selling information and courses, which is a factor and a standard system in centralized capitalism that I just don't think is equitable to the billions of people on this planet who can't afford even the nominal charge of a physical book. That is not accessible if you live on $2 a day, as hundreds of millions plus people do. And to think that they are barred from acting on their own ambition just because they didn't grow up in the right world where they had to have a basic income threshold and the ability to even pay you, which is increasingly difficult without crypto, it's just unfair. It's why I connected so much with the overarching empowering mission of the Stellar ecosystem, because when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was, when I was like 10, 11 years old, I had scrapped together this clunky video game. using a video game making software. And it was like really basic, simple, nothing, right? But I put it on Steam Greenlight and it got into the store. And the last thing I needed to do was put in my banking information and then I would have published a video game. And I didn't have a bank account. I couldn't, I had no clue how to get a bank account. I asked my parents for my bank info and they said no. That was my introduction into finance. It was seeing this permissioned, gate-kept, and exclusive system that only a select few had access to, and for me that meant hopes and dreams down the drain because you can't finish the application onto Steam, at least back then, without that banking info. And it's something that really stuck with me. It hit harder and harder when I started wanting to trade stocks and I had to trade under my parents' accounts, and it was extremely cumbersome to get in there and actually manage the money just because of the way it was configured, not for my own account, but for their accounts, and a lot of technical challenges there just because I was a minor. I didn't know about some of the special accounts that you can set up for minors at the time, and that information, it wasn't available for them. And to think that we have the impeccable fortune, a very large amount of us, of being American citizens, meaning that we can access the most advanced, developed, and liquid capital market on this planet, the most incredulous investments that the world's ever seen. And there are billions of people that just flat out can't access these markets, some of them at all, some of them to the same extent as they try to DRS from abroad, and some of them just because of the transactional costs that don't explicitly bar them from participating. But when you make $2 a day and it's $2 to execute a trade, there's no way you're ever going to invest a meaningful sum of money. That's what I think we have the real power to change here, and to do it in a way where we can sort of form this organizational structure that has its own sources of funding and can be part of this ongoing system. I sort of have this grander vision of what it could look like for all of Web3, and that's Procyon. But on a smaller scale, just for direct registration, proving it out in this one application of building a, because the direct registration systems of yesterday are an Excel spreadsheet. I mean, there's like one software provider that does it for everybody, and it's like they put an Excel spreadsheet on like a cloud server and they put a couple of permission management things on top of it. It is rudimentary at best. Crude is more how I, and unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, this is our real opportunity to do this at scale using a public blockchain that puts the functionality over the centralization and the rent seeking and the gatekeeping, all these problems that exist. And to do that, it really is a redefinition I think we need to look at on how labor itself works, because there are really great ideas that you can put a, for example, the X grants, right? First person to get into space with this rocket, any kinds of systems like that, you're gonna get this huge reward, and that's a bounty for everyone to grab. But the difficulty with the bounties are that it fosters competition, yes. But if there's only like one bounty, then naturally, you've got a lot of people wasting a lot of labor without any consideration, even though they might make some really great work that other people can use. And there's some nuance to this because there are some things like this art project that I referenced for the coin design that explicitly only really need one solution. And so, as I found working on this open source code this last month, is that one of the big factors in this is sort of being reserved the right to work on something so that you know you're putting your effort into work that will actually, your labor will be rewarded as long as you satisfy the criteria. And this is something that came up with a number of artists that sort of circled around in this community and in others on working on that design. There's this conundrum, and I've seen it, you know, outsourcing work of trying to make sure that someone knows that they can really put their effort and their consciousness and their intentions into something, and it'll become, they'll get rewarded for it. And I think most important here is a slight distinction between monetary capital and social capital, in the sense that there is much more incentive to work on something that you know a growing community will appreciate and give you respect for. And that can turn into a sort of form of influence down the line. Ideally, we could formalize this with some kind of labor token. And more to the point, it could be used as an arbiter of how to distribute the funds of a centralized, decentralized pool of capital. And that is certainly, I'd say, a new concept in the whole governance of where to actually allocate money that requires a very broad nonprofit motive of really just letting the community do what it thinks is best, whether the originators of that system agree with it or not. And more to the point, it gets at the conundrum of really wanting to do the work and make sure that labor is incentivized. And I think that the best way to do that is to combine monetary and social capital. And what I explicitly mean by that is that you have the most stock in your own ideas. I believe that hard, full stop. You have an idea, you have a vision. Maybe it's to build a whole product, maybe it's to organize a team, maybe it's just to fix one little or do one little thing, task. And that comes from you. It's decentralized. It's just something that you can see as a clearly important piece of work that you would like to allocate your labor towards. That's where you have not only inspiration, you have social capital in that the community can see that, wow, you came up with this thing and you're working on it and that's incredible. And then you have that monetary capital in the form of rewards for bringing it to the community, taking people's feedback, their ideas, and improving it from their viewpoints, turning that into a final product, and then getting that reward for labor. Because ultimately, it's for a lot of people, it would be nice if you could just pay your rent doing what you'd like to do. And for our community, I think it's so important that the innovators working their tails off to create these incredible solutions, the databases, the information references, the community moderation. Wouldn't it be great if that could translate into some small, just some amount of savings that they could sort of put towards their retirement, their long-term goals? They could really use it as a safety net to build something and know that they'll get rewarded along a similar trajectory as in the private, centralized, rent-extracting market. And I'm not saying it has to be perfect. There are a lot of people that, I have family that, you know, they work in government and they have more impact there than they would have in the private space at a reduction of pay because, you know, ultimately, sort of the skill level that you need, the intensity of the work, those are both very important parts of a job that kind of determine the value that you generate and can demand. But one third factor that's quite often overlooked is the impact that you have. I would much rather make something that helps 7 billion people build real savings in retirement and get paid like 40 grand a year than I would get paid millions of dollars a year and go trade on Wall Street and make a ton of money for the 1%. And that's a choice that personally strams on my feet every day. And I always know that there's such a clear and obvious right choice here. And it's because of the impact that you can have. And I think what we're able to do here with the Dunna structure is really allow for the mix of these social goals, these capitalistic goals, and the impact goals that are the core. It's about combining that community, the funding, and the long-term vision into something that can really change the way our society functions. And when I say how our society functions, what I've said internally in the smaller group discussions, which are now moving over to the public Discord and will be, the plan is to have some of it public, and then people are going to have roles based on their DAO tokens and such that will allow them to go into a more of a private discussion on some nuanced topics. But that's all the governance talk is projected to move sort of into Discord and to be directly with the community. In one of those meetings, I talked about this idea that if we sort of all agree that the future is in space, be better for heavy industry, easier resource access, and, you know, if you didn't throw away a plane every time you flew it, same thing with rockets, right? It becomes exponentially cheaper to operate and such. Well, how do you govern in space? How do you govern, or how do you incentivize things? Or how do you build public works and policies when there really are no borders? There's no physical intimacies. Everything is abundant. You can always expand the station. These are the crucial systems that can build on what we create here in developing, promoting, and adopting the direct registration system. We can show the world that there are frameworks in place to let a very decentralized group of people work at their own pace to build something that actually replaces what was previously thought of as systemically important financial utilities. It's something that's only possible because we have this new technology that allows for this global collaboration in a very transparent manner. And having built sort of private companies myself, I can see very clearly the parallels between the tools we have in our expanding resource kit, the discussions, the issues, the repositories. It's the exact same stuff that the centralized guys are working with. So, if not better, because it's developed for the expanding network of all internet users. And that's what we have the potential to contribute to. And it's why I am so excited for getting the IRS filings in to formalize it into a nonprofit and to sustain the labor that really affects everyone here and is the core of our governance ideas. So if you have any questions, please come on the mic and talk about it. Or, of course, I'll be in the new channels specifically for a lot of these governance discussions. Ultimately, I think what's at stake here is a redefinition of incenting labor. And if we can do this sustainably for this direct registration challenge, then what we'll build in the process by doing everything transparently and out into the public and giving it all back to the world, it really has the potential for some stellar impact. All right, well, thanks so much for joining us today on Taking Stock. And if there's no one else to come on, I'll leave it back to the community discussions. Decided to move on to these next steps.